All right. Well, I have some homework for you. So if you have your papers and pencil, right? Now it's all going to be in the notes. I've written up 12 pages of notes for chapter 12, and all of this stuff is in the notes. But just in case, I would give you the following little bits of homework. We're going to start with verse number 1 and 2, 12, 1 and 2, very famous verses. Right about not being conformed to this world, but be transformed as living sacrifice, all that stuff. And so I looked at everything that I have written in the past that makes, that contributes to understanding this concept. And so I want to give you the following. And I'm just going to give you the date for each one of these today's words so that you can go on my website and check them out. But as I said, all of the URLs are in the notes. Okay, so February 15, 2023, January 24, 2023, August 2nd, 2017, October 27, 2021, June 18, 2020, and all the way back to June 21st, 2013. So obviously there's some stuff about that I've been thinking about on this verse for the last 10 years since the first one was 2013. And that means that there's way too much material for us to discuss in just trying to get through this chapter with just those first two verses. But I would recommend that you take a look at all that reading, that already written material, because it talks about conformity to the world and the living idea of the living sacrifice. We'll touch on those now, but now you have some background material. Okay. And then we'll start in earnest with the current notes when we get to verse 3. But let's start just for a second and see the NASB translation, and then let's look at Earle's translation, and then I'll talk a little bit about the differences in the words. Okay, so the NASB, which is the one you're probably familiar with. I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. Okay? And Uriel says for the same. Let me get it really quick. Brothers, I urge you accordingly, exploiting the kindness of God, to make your body and soul suitable as a benefaction, living in a holy, pleasing manner before God. This is your tangible act of divine service. So I want to make some points about the differences here, okay? First, I want to point out that I'm not convinced, although it might be true in the Greek, I'm not convinced that Paul would have said to make your body and soul. Because as you know, soul is a Greek concept, but it's not a Hebrew concept. So in the standard translation, the standard Greek text, it just says, to present your bodies. And of course, the word there is soma, right? Uriel has added body and soul, which he would have to have the word psuche in Greek. But I don't think that that's what Paul has in mind anyway, because he's not a dualist. He's not saying, I want you to present your body as and also your soul. He's talking about an embodied person. So the correct Hebrew translation would be nefesh or neshima. And the idea is this embodiment, the whole person. Uriel tries to capture that with body and soul. The NASB, of course, just uses the word soma, but neither one of those actually captures, I think, what Paul is really saying, because if we rely on his Hebrew perspective, we will notice that he's talking about not just part of you, but the whole of you. So I want you to present the whole of you, your whole persona, okay? And now we have this really interesting phrase, living sacrifice. We should make a note. I write about all this stuff, so you can get the details if you want. But we should make a note that the same word for spiritual service is also sometimes rendered as Uriel renders it, a tangible act of divine worship. Okay, so that again is a Hebrew concept, right? The idea of work, worship, and service all come under the same Hebrew word. So depending on which word Paul chooses to express a Greek idea, he's still thinking in terms of this homogenized Hebrew concept that avodah, which is the word for work, that you find as early as Genesis chapter 2, also means to worship and to serve. So all three of those concepts are bound up in what Paul's saying in this first verse. So from a Hebrew perspective, your whole person, which is involved in work, worship, and service, needs to be presented as a living sacrifice. Now, the idea of a living sacrifice, as you probably already know, comes from a Talmudic passage. It talks about what happens when a sacrifice is presented to a priest to be sacrificed at the altar, and after the priest accepts it, they discover that it has some blemish, right? So now it can't be sacrificed because it has some blemish, but it can't be returned to the owner because it's already been accepted by the priest. Therefore, that animal now becomes a property of the temple and spends the rest of its life basically on the temple grounds or under the governance of the temple authorities until it dies. So that's a perfect perfect metaphor for what Paul is trying to say here. Because obviously, if you were presented as a sacrifice, you would die, right? But you're a living sacrifice, which of course is a contradiction in terms, but not a contradiction if you understand the Jewish background. You are presented as a sacrifice, accepted, but blemished. So you can't be sacrificed in reality. You can't be offered and killed. You have to be within the purview of the temple. You have to be, you now belong to the temple, or in this case, you belong to the kingdom, and you can't be returned to the world, but you have to live out the rest of your natural existence under the kingdom. So the living sacrifice is a perfect metaphor for what Paul's trying to communicate here. Okay? So in the first verse, we get the whole person, the living sacrifice, and work, worship, and serve. All Hebrew ideas combined in the first verse. Okay? So now let's look at the second verse. And the second verse is obviously, again, a very familiar verse. I read it to you in the NASB. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, that is good and acceptable and preferable. Okay? And Uriel basically says, and don't be a schematic representation of this earth, of this age. And the reason he says that is because the Greek word for conformity there is schema, right? We get schematic from that. So he's just doing a pretty much a literal translation. And the whole idea is to not be conformed to a pattern, a schema. It isn't, you know, Paul's idea is not random influences from the world. Paul's idea is that the world has a particular pattern, the way that it does things, a workflow process. And he doesn't want you to be conformed to that. Okay? And so Uriel says, do not become a schematic representation of the earth, of the age. Now, this is important because Paul uses particular Greek words that have a different meaning in Greek than they would for us in English today. So, for example, he says, do not be conformed to this world. Uriel translates that as age. The idea is not cosmos, but eon. It means when Paul says to this world, he's talking about a particular historical, temporal, cultural occurrence. Okay, he's saying to his audience, which makes perfect sense, don't be conformed to the patterns of the Roman Empire. We can extrapolate from that, of course, and say, well, we don't want to be conformed to any of the patterns that represent something other than God's kingdom, which is appropriate. But for Paul, he's only thinking in terms of, he's not thinking of the total world. He's thinking of the environment that the members of this assembly have to deal with every day. He's thinking of their daily existence, and their daily existence is to be, citizens or members of the Roman Empire. So whatever those patterns are, that's what Paul has in mind. Now, it's interesting to me that we still hang on to those same patterns in the West, right? That the Western civilization is basically an extension of the same kind of approach that was taken to understanding the universe in Rome. We have the same social structures. We have the same legal structures. We have the same view toward education. We basically have the same view toward law and justice. We are the products of Rome, Rome and Greece, right? Might be true in the West. Might not be true in the East, because there the historical patterns are much different. But for Paul, he's writing into this Greek Hellenized culture, and the Greek Hellenized culture is the same one that we find in our own tradition and in our history. And it's really foundational to the way that we think about life. So the interesting thing about that is we can directly apply Paul's concern for the assembly in Rome to us, because we face the same kind of schematic of the of the West that they faced in the Roman Empire. So we're going to have to talk a little bit more about that and see what that amounts to. But let's first continue with the verse and see what other words he uses. So he says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Now, this is a really interesting concept, because we would think, oh my gosh, Paul is now being a rationalist. He's saying that the way that you're going to get out of this problem of not being absorbed into the patterns of the Roman Empire is to use your rational thinking to process a way to remove yourself from those influences that you see in the empire, right? Because that's what it looks like in Greek. And in fact, he uses phronesis, which is a word that comes from nous, means mind, okay? But what's really interesting is, from a Hebrew perspective, you wouldn't say that. You wouldn't say, oh, the most important thing in from a Hebrew perspective is to think differently. Because in Hebrew, the thing that makes a difference in life is acting, not thinking. In fact, you can almost say from a Hebrew perspective that you can believe whatever you want as long as you act according to Torah, right? Because the mental capacity is not the foundation of how Judaism sees man's relationship to the world, okay? So this is a really interesting problem, because it means that what Paul's trying to capture can only be expressed in Greek by renewing of the mind, but we know from a Jewish perspective that isn't what he would be saying if he were writing in Hebrew, okay? So let's see how Uriel handles that. He says, rather, undergo a change for restoration of the mind. Okay, it's a restoration maybe, but I think that we have to step back from this, from the cognitive influence of the word mind in Greek nous. We have to step back from that and say, okay, wait a minute. Paul is exhorting these people to have a different perspective than the current culture, the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire, based on Hellenism, is cognitive. That's one of its schema, right? The rational explanation of the universe is fundamental to a Hellenistic view, right? So, and we talked about this before, so from a Hellenistic perspective, what matters is rationally conceived ethics, right? I think my way into what is proper. But from Paul's perspective, it isn't rational ethics that he's interested in. It's the divine law given in a revelation that comes from outside the cognitive world, okay? So when Paul talks about renewing of your mind, he can't mean go read Aristotle. He can't mean, you know, take some time to think through the Platonic issues of ethics. Now, what he means, has to mean, is by renewing your mind, take that Hellenistic pattern that you've come into the assembly with, because now he's writing to the Gentiles, right? I want you to be not conformed to the pattern of the world that you came from, and renew your mind. And how's that going to happen? Well, it's going to happen exactly as James and Peter suggested in Acts 5. How is that? How do you renew your mind? According to Acts 15 discussion, you renew your mind by learning Moses every week, right? So the process of renewing your mind isn't cognitively thinking differently. It's absorbing, it's immersing yourself in Torah, which is a revelation, not a rational explanation. Okay? And I think this is really important for us because this verse is often used to sort of propose a foundation, a justification for rationally based ethics, right? That we can just think our way into the good. But I don't think Paul's saying that at all, because what I think Paul's saying by renewing your mind, you need to absorb, you need to immerse yourself in Torah so that you start acting and thinking according to Torah, not according to the pattern of the world, right? So here's the point. This passage and a whole bunch of chapters following this are addressed to the Gentiles who are coming into the assembly. Okay? We've seen in chapters 9, 10, and 11 an address to the Jews, right? 9, 10, 11, all about what's going to happen to the Jews. So Paul, in the first 8 chapters, Paul talks about the general approach. What happens to everybody? We're all in the same boat. We all have to deal with this issue of sin. What does the Messiah have to do with us? Chapter 5. Chapter 6, 7. What about this internal struggle? Yitzhak Hara, Yitzhak Hatov. Chapter 8. God has a solution for this. Then the next part of the letter addresses one part of the audience, the Jews. Okay? And what Paul says is, okay, wait a minute. The Gentiles are coming in, but I don't want you to think that that means you're being displaced. Okay? And he goes through 9, 10, 11, a long discussion of his opinion about how the Jews fit into all this. Okay? And that makes perfect sense because the assembly that the Gentiles are coming into is Jewish. Okay? Now he gets to 12. And now he has to address the other part of the audience, which are the Gentiles. So the first thing that he says is, listen, when you come into this assembly, the first thing I want you to recognize is that you are a living sacrifice and that you have a duty for work, worship, and serve that means that you have to change the way that you act in the world. You have to no longer be conformed to the patterns of Hellenism that you're coming from. Now, obviously, he wouldn't be saying that to a Jewish audience because they already aren't conformed to the Hellenistic pattern, right? So he has to be addressing now the Gentiles from a Jewish perspective, saying, I want you to absorb this Jewish way of life, right? And these passages then can only apply to those people who are coming out of a Hellenistic background, and maybe some Jews that were Hellenized, but nevertheless, it's mostly Gentiles who are now trying to absorb this Hebraic way of acting and thinking. Okay? So now he says, I don't want you to be conformed to anything that you've come from, the Hellenism. I want you to have this new way of understanding your relationship to the world and to God. And he says, as a result of that, you will prove what is the will of God. But the only way you can prove what's the will of God is to be absorbed in the Torah, because that is the expression of God's will, right? And then he says, to find out what is good and acceptable. But from Paul's perspective, we already know because of his discussion of the law that what's good and acceptable is matched up with Torah, right? So if I take these verses and rip them out of their context of writing to a Gentile audience that's coming into a Jewish synagogue, if I think that Paul's just simply addressing the church, then I won't read this as though Paul is saying, you need to absorb Torah, you need to immerse yourself in Torah, you need to spend time rethinking your life in terms of Torah, because now Torah won't be a part of the equation, right? I need to understand what audience he's addressing and why he would say, you, this audience, need to be transformed, whereas he's not saying that to all of the audience. Do you understand what I'm saying? The two verses have to be addressed to a Gentile audience that needs transformation, not to the Jewish audience. So if I read it according to Paul's Jewish thinking, then it makes perfect sense. If I read it according to the Christian church, it makes it look like everyone who becomes a Christian, Jew and Gentile, need to be transformed according to what? The will of God. But we don't know what the will of God is anymore because we've left Torah behind, right? Big, big change in how I understand what the audience and the message is. Okay? So now let's proceed on the basis that you're going to go read all those things that I gave you. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different, you know, topics there. You're going to get the background for what it means for conformity to the world and all that kind of stuff. But let's proceed now on the basis that Paul is going to address a Gentile audience that's in the synagogue, and he's going to talk to them deliberately about what they need to do in order to fit into the full membership of the synagogue, that they joined. Yeah, Adi, you had something you want to add?
Yeah, just one question here. On my verse says, what is good, acceptable, and perfect? Well, I had a look at perfect. There's lots of definition, but I would think the perfect here would be a fulfillment rather than something that is perfect. It can be added to it or taken away from it.
Okay, good point. And let's go see just real quickly. I will tell you, and I got a pretty good idea what that is, but I just want to check. Okay. So if I check this and I see here, I see that, yep, that's what I thought. So the root, the Greek root for perfect is the root that's based on the word teleos, right? And as you pointed out, it doesn't mean what we think of as perfect, because we think of perfect as without error, right? If you get a perfect exam, every single question was answered correctly. But teleos is a Greek word that means to complete, to fulfill, to achieve the goal. It doesn't necessarily mean without error. So you can have a perfect life and still make mistakes, because your life is completed in the kingdom, right? We have a word teleology that in English that comes directly from this Greek word. And teleology is the study of the end purpose, right? So that makes a big difference. And I think Uriel captures that when he says to discern what is good and sufficient and flawless, right? It's the flawless will. It's the end goal that's in mind, teleos. Okay, Lindy?
Yeah, Stern translates it. What does he say? He says, so that you will know that God wants what God wants and will agree what is good, satisfying, and able to succeed.
Able to succeed, right? To fulfill, to complete, right? Yeah.
Perfection.
Yes. And the important thing is that Greek word, teleos, is often mistranslated as perfect and creates all kinds of moral issues for Christians, because think of Matthew 5:48, where Yeshua says, be therefore perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But that's not what it says in Hebrew, and it's certainly not what it means in Greek, because what it means is to be complete, to be. And actually, Paul's going to use the same idea with a different word in a little bit, to be filled with shalom. To be well, to have well-being, right? Which doesn't mean that you do everything without any mistakes. It means that the direction and purpose of your life is filled with this connection to God, so that what you're doing is satisfying His will. Okay? All right? So, by the way, you can go back to Matthew 5:48 and change that in your English text as well, because it's a big problem. Because if the standard is to be perfect, none of us make it. But if the standard is to be completed according to God, then we're looking at a lifetime of effort that ultimately results in God being pleased, right? That was the whole idea. Okay, so now let's go to 3, because now it starts to get, I may have written stuff about 3, but I didn't include it in the notes. But I want to talk about some of the words that are in 3, okay? So he says in 3. For through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you, do not think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. Okay, there's several really important Jewish ideas going on here. Okay, the first one, of course, is about an exaggerated opinion of yourself. And it's really interesting that the word is huperphrenio, Okay, and it comes from the same word that think that's about mind. Remember he said renewing of your mind? Okay, so what he's saying is don't, if you're going through this process, don't start saying to yourself, oh my gosh, I've got it. Oh, I'm doing so well. Oh my, look at all the things that I've learned and all the stuff that I know. And you know what, Dennis, I wish you were on my level, but you know, I just know more than you. I mean, you know, you understand? It doesn't even have to be as bold and as crass as that. It's just the internal thinking that says, I know more. I'm better equipped. I'm better off, right? And so what Paul is saying is that exaggerated opinion of yourself leads to some really interesting problems, okay? And you'll notice that it's the same idea as renewing your mind. So what Paul is saying is, I want you to renew your mind, and we talked about that, but he's also warning you not to think that because you're doing that, you're somehow going to elevate yourself. Okay? Use the same, there's a good side to it and a bad side to it, and he's just warning you against the possibility that you may end up on the negative side. Then he says, as God has allotted to you a measure of faith. Okay, so there's a very interesting thing going on here. Here's a statement from a rabbinic view, and I think it really follows with what Paul has in mind, although obviously now we're looking at a rabbinic view that's 2,000 years later, right? So God has allotted, and here's what the rabbis say. A person's entire livelihood is allocated to him during the period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. During this time, as each individual is judged, it is decreed exactly how much money he will earn for all of his expenditures for the coming year, except for expenditures for Shabbat, expenditures for festivals, and expenditures for school fees of his son's Torah study. In these areas, no exact amount is determined at the beginning of the year. Rather, if he reduced the amount he spends for these purposes, his income is reduced, and he earns much less money in the last year. And if he increases his expenditures in these areas, his income is increased to ensure that he can cover the expense. Therefore, one may borrow for these purposes since he is guaranteed to have enough income to cover whatever he spends for them. Okay? Just think about how we've taken this idea of allotment and expanded it so that we have a justification for borrowing money for my son's Torah study. You can't borrow the money for anything else, but if you borrow it for Torah study, according to the rabbinic idea, God will ensure that your income increases to cover that expense, because obviously Torah study is the, you know, most important thing that you can do. Okay? So I just find it interesting that the notion of allotment, which goes all the way back to, you know, the Exodus, right? When the land is parceled out by according to God's allotment, is still present in Paul and finds its way 2,000 years later in rabbinic thinking about God assigning how much income you will make during the year, right? Isn't that an interesting idea? I mean, here Paul is talking about allotment of faith, but it doesn't take very much in a transcendental rabbinic environment to believe that God allots everything to your life, so that everything that happens to you is according to what God allots to you during this certain period of time, and it, you know, it's renewed each year so that it varies according to your merit between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay? I just thought you'd find that interesting. Yes?
Yeah, we can max out our credit card and come over and see you.
Yeah, that's right. No, only if your son's Torah study depends on it. Right?
No, it's our Torah study with you.
Okay. All right. So, anyway, the point is that Paul is recognizing, and again, this is a Jewish idea, right? Paul is recognizing that the measure of grace given to you so that you can accomplish the renewing of your mind without falling into the idea of an exaggerated sense of yourself is handled by God, right? That God is the one who decides how your life is going to go. Oswald Chambers would say that God engineers your life so that those things that happen will lead you in the path that he wants you to follow, right? And that's done by God, not by you, right? To keep you on the track of Torah immersion so that you think and behave differently, and to prevent you from becoming the kind of person who thinks that you have all the answers, or at least you suspect that you have all the answers, although you would never say that because it's not socially acceptable, right? Okay, so you see what Paul's doing? He's using another Jewish idea of allotment to bolster his argument with this Gentile population, because quite frankly, the Gentile population that's coming in out of Hellenism doesn't believe that there's, in the past they might have believed that the divinities were in charge of life, but now they've discovered the God of Israel. They've left those pagan divinities behind, so now it falls on them to create their own world. And what Paul is saying is, nope, that's not quite right. God has a hand in how much he's allotted to you for the purposes of fulfilling his will. Okay? So that takes us to verse 4, right? And verse 4 says, for just as we have many members of one body, and all members do not have the same function, and we have to continue, so we, who are many, are one body in Christ, and individually members one of another. Two really important concepts going on here. And again, in the notes, I will give you the URL link to things that I've written about this in the past for both of those verses, okay? But I think what you need to discover here, and what we need to talk about for a few minutes, is the connection between the individual and the body, okay? Because Paul is thinking Hebrew. So he's not thinking each individual person has a responsibility and task to complete that he can do on his own. What he's thinking about is the individual's connection to the body in itself, right? That each part of the body as the whole, the most important part, the unit, is made up of the tasks that you have to perform inside that basically nourish the whole, right? So from Paul's perspective, the smallest unit is not the individual. The smallest unit is the assembly, the whole. And that's where I measure my individual contribution, okay? And I want to give you an example from a Greek word, karpon, which means fruit, okay? So the idea is this. If you think of yourself, and maybe I've talked to this before, so I don't want to bore you, so I'll just do it quickly.
Hey, Skip, there's a couple open mics.
Oh, okay, so let's make sure that doesn't happen anymore. I don't know how to do that. Mute. Okay, so here's the word, karpon, right? And karpon is the word that means fruit. And the idea is, if you think of yourself as a fruit tree, you produce a certain kind of fruit. So orange trees produce oranges. They don't produce pears, right? But every fruit tree has its own kind of fruit that it produces. As a result of the production of the fruit, the tree does not survive by being fed its own production, right? You know that if you plant orange tree and you get oranges, and then you plant the oranges near the orange tree underneath the tree to nourish it, you will kill the tree because you make the soil too acidic. Okay, so the point that karpon gives us in Greek is that each fruit tree is designed to nourish something else, not itself, but all the trees together form an orchard where every individual in the community receives nourishment from everyone else except themselves. The whole point is, you can't eat your own fruit. You have to eat the fruit that's produced by others. Okay? So you are interdependent on everyone else in the community to provide you with the nourishment that you need in order to fulfill your purpose within the community. And the point being that if you start hoarding your own fruit, your own gift, you will not only starve the rest of the community, you prevent them from having the benefit of your gift, but you will also kill yourself because you can't live on what you produce. Okay? So to put it in terms of what we're doing here, my role is different than yours. And if I'm going to fulfill my role according to God's purpose, I need to be teaching you. And you need to be nourishing me. And each one of you has a role that involves nourishing others, but not yourself. I don't teach myself. I teach in order to distribute information, not in order to retain it, right? I mean, I could just, you know, mark all my books in the back on the shelves there and say, oh my gosh, look how much I know. I mean, isn't it wonderful? And I could show you all my degrees and everything else, and you'd think, oh my gosh, that guy knows so much. I don't dare even ask a question. That if I did that, I would destroy the purpose of me being in the community, because the purpose of me being in the community is to assist you to know the things that God wants me to deliver to you. Okay? That's my purpose. Your purpose is not to sit there as a passive recipient of what I say. Your purpose is to discover your role and in response to that, fulfill your purpose, as Adi pointed out, complete what God has in mind for you so that you nourish me and everybody else, right? You see, it's completely interdependent. So when Paul's talking about this relationship between the individual and the body, we must always keep in mind that Paul is not thinking in terms of the individual, primarily in terms of the individual. He's thinking about the whole. How does it work so that everyone else is nourished by what I do? And of course, that means I have to do what I do, because if I stop doing it, everyone else is harmed. And if I try to hoard it, I kill myself off. Okay. Now, why is this important? Because there's a book, this book, which I'm working my way through for the second time, Mesillat Yesharim, the foundation of all of, I mean, we should be reading Luzzatto as a commentary on Romans. Because the foundation of Luzzatto is that you have an infinite responsibility for the other, not for yourself, and that you owe an infinite debt to everyone else because your very consciousness of who you are came about because of the people who nourished you, right? Not only did you not choose to be born, so you were the result of somebody else's conscious choice, you are also, as soon as you are born, obligated to the community that provides you with the very awareness of who you are. So Luzzatto is fundamental to understanding what Paul's saying. In fact, I would say that if it weren't for the fact that the Christian church, the Christian church basically took, they captured Paul for themselves. If that hadn't happened, Luzzatto would be quoting Paul in his book to say, you see this first century Jewish rabbi, he's saying the same thing that I am, right? So
what's the name of the book?
The name of the book is Mesillat Yesharim, The Way of the Righteous.
Okay, thank you.
And can I point out, please, that this is the edition that you want, right? It's printed by the Jewish Publication Society, and the commentary is by Ira Stone, right? The reason you want that is because at some point we're going to do this book. I've now working my way through the citations. I've got 400 citations so far because it's just filled with really good stuff, and I'm going to share a few of those with you as we go along. But nevertheless, the point is that Luzzatto's approach is that your very being depends on the relationship that you have to the community. And that's a very deep Jewish idea, a Jewish ontology that begins with relationship. It doesn't begin with the individual, right? It begins with relationship. And that's what Paul's saying to these Gentiles. The Gentiles are coming in as individual people. And he's saying, no, wait a minute. you no longer view yourself as an individual. You view yourself now as a connected part of the larger body, and your task, if you're not going to be conformed to the Hellenism that you're coming from, is to fit into how you produce for everyone else in the community and be nourished by everyone else's production. Okay? So, verse 5. Oh, that's 4 and 5. Okay? So let's look at 6. Again, I have three different pieces that I've written on 6. One from 2020, two from 2019. They'll be in the notes. You can go look at that. But I want to point out that he says, and since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us. Okay, so this is really interesting. Because the first thing he says is, you Gentiles who come into the assembly, recognize that God has given you a gift. My gosh, I didn't ask for it. God gave it to me. And everyone's gift is a little bit different because it depends on the journey that got you there, all the things that God did to engineer in your life to bring you to the point where you have a gift to share with the body, okay? It's interesting that the gift here is the word charismata, right? Charismata, as you know, in the Pentecostal tradition, became a distribution of multiple gifts. It became the hallmark of a particular way of understanding Scripture, and in particular, spiritual gifts. But charismata doesn't mean spiritual gifts. Charismata means gift. And Paul is now going to outline what those gifts are, and we'll have to remind ourselves over and over that he's not saying that these are spiritual. What he's saying is that they fit into the ordinary functions of living, that they're daily kinds of processes, that they're actions that occur in daily life. Okay? So now he says that you have these gifts, and since every one of you has a gift that differs according to the grace given to you, let each one exercise them accordingly. That's in the NASB. It's not in the Greek, right? And now he starts with the gifts. And the first one is prophecy, right? The original sense of the Greek word prophetia is not what we mean by prophecy, because by the third century, the church turned prophecy into prediction, right? A prognostication. That's not what the Greek means in the first century. In the first century, and particularly the connection to the Septuagint, prophecy means declaration. It doesn't mean prediction, okay? So the first gift is to be able to declare, that is, to be able to communicate something that needs to be unpacked so that you can understand what it is. And this is what the prophets do. The prophets are not predictors. They're not prognosticators, right? And in fact, if we understood Jewish prophecy correctly, we would realize that any prediction in Jewish prophecy is always contingent and depends on changing circumstances. And Neusner would say, the point of Jewish prophecy is to not come true. Okay? Let's think about that for a second. The whole point of prophecy is to not happen. Why? Because God gives a prediction, a contingent prediction that says, if you continue to do these things, then I will do this. But the point of the contingent prediction is so that you won't continue to do these things. And Nineveh is the perfect example. Remember what the king of Nineveh says when Jonah first shows up. It's a really important verse. He says, who knows? Maybe God will change his mind. I mean, it's perfect because that's exactly what prophecy is supposed to do. It's supposed to change your mind. It's supposed to change the way that you behave so that the prediction will not happen. And that's basically why Jonah is so upset, because he wants the prediction to happen, and he knows that if he goes there and tells them, the chances are that they will change their mind, and the prophecy won't occur, and then he'll look like a prophet who didn't get his, you know, he didn't get his prophecy fulfilled, okay? But that's the point of Jewish prophecy. It's all about declaration with contingency so that it will change people's mind because they understand what it says. Okay? So the point of prophecy is to declare is to unravel, to unpack something so that you see what it means, so that it initiates a change in behavior. Okay? So now Paul says, prophecy. If prophecy, according to the proportion of his faith. Okay? So why would he say that? Because does he mean that if I have more faith, I'll be able to predict more things? That's the way the end times theology people look at it. Oh my gosh, if I just have more faith, if I pray more for understanding, God will tell me what's going to happen at the end. Okay? I mean, it's quite frankly bull. There's nothing in scripture that allows you to make that kind of assumption, as far as I'm concerned, because prophecy is not history in advance. Okay? What it says is that my ability to unpack things, my ability to unravel the mysteries, my ability to make clear what God has in mind depends on the trusting relationship that I have with God, which is faith, right? The deeper my trusting relationship, the more I will understand what it is that God's trying to communicate and be able to relate that to you, okay? And the reason that the prophets are so important is because God chooses them in order to reveal his heart to them so that they clearly understand what he is feeling and they feel it, which is why Jeremiah can say, I wish I'd never been born, because he has the brokenheartedness of God, which is why Amos and Zechariah and all the prophets are disturbed men, because they feel what God feels. So the level, the degree of their trusting relationship is deep enough so that God is confident that if he reveals himself to them in all of his emotion, they will be able to handle it. And sometimes they can. And sometimes they can't. Sometimes it's too much. Right? That's the idea of a prophet. Okay? Prophet is not someone who gives you his card that says prophet. The prophet is someone who unpacks something for you so that you can actually experience what it is that God's trying to communicate. Right? It's kind of what we're doing in this class, going along and looking deeply into the word so that we understand what Paul's saying from a different perspective. Okay? That's what we're doing. All right? Let's look at the second gift. Okay? First gift, prophecy. Second one. If service in his serving, okay, that sounds like, an oxymoron, a tautology, right? If I'm going to serve in my serving, okay, well, what else would I do if I was in my serving? But now we need to look at the Greek, and that tells us a little bit about what's going on there. Because the Greek is, we're very familiar with, diakonos, right? It's, and we have an office in the modern church called the deacon. But the actual fact is that the word means to serve, to wait on tables. It comes from the idea of, originally, from the idea of a waiter. Okay? So what is the point of a diakonos? It's to be able to understand a person's need and serve it without them asking. That's the whole point. To diakonos in diake, right? In other words, to intuitively know what it is that needs to be done so that I don't need to ask for it, but you see the need and you fill it. And you can think of this in a real simple example. The really great waiter when you go to a restaurant is not the waiter that you have to call over to the table to provide you with water or a fork that you spilled on the, or that you dropped on the floor or another napkin. It's the waiter who anticipates all that. And you don't even know that he's been there to fill your water glass. Or if you drop the fork, he's immediately there with the fork to give you a new one. Or whatever, right? A black napkin if you're wearing black clothing. It's the waiter who is invisible to the process of filling a need. Okay? So it's nice to have an office called deacon, but it doesn't mean much if the deacon's office becomes a visible part of the church hierarchy, right? The whole point of a diakonos is someone who serves without you recognizing that they fulfill the need, okay? That's number two. And you can see that this isn't a spiritual thing. It's a very practical thing, right? If I learn that one of you need something, and you don't even know that I know, but I know that I can fulfill that need, and I go ahead and do it without you even asking, That's diakonos, right? Okay, next one. Teaching, didasko. So didaskale is to teach, but this is an important concept that is different in Hebrew than it is in Greek, okay? So in Greek thinking, a teacher is responsible for communicating the material to the student, okay? And it's the teacher's job to make sure that the student understands. So didaskale is about the process of communicating information so that the student understands. But in Hebrew thought, it's the student's responsibility to understand what the teacher says. It's exactly the opposite, right? One of them is a receptive mode. The other is a transmitting mode. Our idea of education is based on a transmitting mode, right? It comes from Hellenism, that it's the teacher's responsibility to transmit the information. The Jewish idea is a receptive mode. It's the student's responsibility to understand what the teacher said, okay? So a disciple of a rabbi is responsible for understanding what the rabbi says because the issue of education falls on the student, not on the teacher, okay? So here we have the didaskalo. What does that mean? It means that the teacher needs to communicate in such a way that the student has every opportunity possible to understand. But it's not the teacher's responsibility to make the student understand. You understand? It's the student's responsibility to grasp the opportunity that the teacher provides and absorb it so that I understand, that I'm the student and I understand, okay? Which means that the student has the right to bug the teacher until the student understands. And the teacher has the obligation to continue to provide to the student because from a teacher's perspective, my role is to make sure that I'm communicating in such a way that you have every possible opportunity to understand something. But it's not my role to make you understand it. That's your role. Okay?
Did you have something? The verse that talks about the Bereans doing everything to figure out what Paul was it Paul or Peter or they were
commended. The Berean verse that says, okay, well, they were very interested in what he had to say, and they were going to go back to Scripture to see if it conformed to what they already knew from Scripture. Okay? So they're listening to Paul. He's acting as a diaskale. He's acting as a teacher. They're absorbing that information, but it's their responsibility to check it out because they're held accountable for what they believe to be the case, having heard what Paul says. Okay? Paul's not responsible for making them believe. Paul's responsible for communicating in such a way that they have every opportunity to understand what he's saying. And that might mean that he has to spend 3 years in Ephesus in debate, right? 3 years of going over the same material so that they will get it. But in the end, he's not responsible for them to get it, right? A big change in the way that we understand education in our system today, because we have education based on the Greco-Roman Hellenistic view. So the parents hold the teacher responsible if their son is getting a D in the class. But in Hebrew, that would be the son's problem, not the teacher's problem, right? Okay? Because it's the son who's responsible for making sure that he gets what the teacher is saying. Okay?
But it just explains that verse on Bereans that we've used in many ways, but now we understand the context of it. So that's good.
Yeah. So the point is but notice that what we have now is the third gift. The first gift is unpacking, revealing, making clear something that was hidden before, right? Something we didn't understand before. Now it's clear, okay? The second gift, serving in such a way that my invisible efforts benefit you, okay? Without credit to me. The third gift, to communicate every possible opportunity for you to absorb something, for you to get it, to find every possible way to make that happen. Okay, now let's look at the fourth one. Or he who exhorts in his exhortation. So that's pretty much indecipherable in English. What does that mean? You stand on the street corner and you exhort, but you should do it with exhortation. That means you should be louder. No, all right? Not exactly. So let's see what he has to say for this. For exhort is the word parakaleto, which you recognize. The parakaleto means to come alongside, right? So exhort is the wrong kind of English word here. Let's see what Uriel uses in verse 4, or maybe it's 5. Let's see, what verse are we in? For he who exhorts. Oh, 8. Sorry. So Uriel says, the one providing encouraging comfort by using the instrument of that provision to comfort. And he's exactly right, because exhort is the wrong word. It's not about the guy standing on the street corner saying that you're going to go to hell as loud as he can. The idea of parakaleto is to come alongside. It's to be of comfort in the deepest possible way. So what Paul is saying is, to some of you have a gift of comforting. So look, my bedside manner in the hospital is horrible, right? Why? Because all I'm interested in is, what does the word mean? Right? So I'm going to sit down with the patient and say, let's grab the copy of Luzzatto's book and look at this paragraph. Right? Now, that's not going to help. And as my wife said, it's a good thing you were never a doctor. I could be a surgeon, because surgeons don't have to talk to their patients. They're out, right? Okay. But I could not be a general practitioner, because my ability to empathize is pretty low. Okay. But there are some people that are just natural comforters. I mean, they have this ability to connect with a person's heart, so that I feel like that person really understands what I'm going through. They really understand me. That is a gift, according to Paul, and not everyone has it. It's a gift that says you have the ability to identify with another person's emotional state in such a way that they feel that someone really knows them. And according to Paul, do it with all the gusto you have. Right? Remember, Paul is talking about gifts that are distributed among the assembly. Not everyone has the same gift, and not everyone has multiples, right? What he's saying is, each one of these gifts is necessary for the whole to be benefited. So you can't have an assembly where there's no one who unpacks things. You can't have an assembly where no one does the invisible service for people's needs. You can't have a total assembly if you have no one there who comforts, right? If you go to a church and all they're doing is preaching the word for salvation Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, and all you hear is the same teaching message over and over, but there's no feeling there, it's not an assembly that Paul has in mind. Paul wants the full assembly. He wants all the gifts to show up. He wants you to go to a place where there's someone there who identifies and who has an empathetic connection with you. Okay? That's what he has in mind. So let's look at the next one, 5, the fifth one. He who gives with liberality. Okay, well, the church loves this one, because that basically they use that to say, you see, God wants you to give more. I mean, they forget that this is a gift, so it's not for everyone. And it has a very specific kind of meaning. The Greek term is metadidomai. Metadidomai comes from the word that means a share of, to have a part, a share of. Okay? And what Paul is saying is that there are some people who naturally have a gift for managing shares. Okay? There are some people who are just fabulous administrators. They know how to manage the resources. They know what to do with the shares that everyone has. Okay? So they know what to do with the finances. They know what to do with the personnel. They know what to do with the resources from the building. They know what to do with the administrative issues. They know how to manage things. Okay? And because metadidomai is this gift to know how to put things into use for the maximum benefit. Okay? So obviously in the assembly, you need somebody who can do that. If you have a full assembly and you have some people who are unpacking and some who are serving and some who are teaching and some who are exhorting, you still need somebody who's a great administrator. And remember, it's a gift. So I can tell you the number of times that I was in a church and they looked around the assembly and said, we need someone to administer the church's finances. Oh, you're an accountant. You should do it. Wrong. Right? Because this is a gift. It's not a trade. It's not a career. It's something that God provided that one person has this ability to just know how to manage resources. Okay? So that means that it might be, you know, it might be the lady that you have working in the kindergarten class, but she really knows how to manage resources and she should be the one who's in charge of handling all the resources that the community has. And it's not just the resources of money, it's everything. How do you distribute personal involvement? How do you get people in the right places at the right time? All of that, says Paul, is a gift, metadidomai. Okay? Let's look at the next one. The next one is he who leads with diligence. So the Greek word is prohistome, and it means to stand. But it's the word for standing up as a leader. Now, this is really, really interesting, because what Paul is saying is leadership is a gift. It doesn't come about because I sent you to a class, right? I want to improve your leadership skills, so I send you to a class so that you become a great leader. Sorry, doesn't work like that. Great leaders are gifted to be great leaders, and the issue is that they lead with humility. They don't lead from strength. They lead from humility, right? So how do you determine who's a great leader? You see who's following, right? Great leaders attract followers. Simple. I look behind me. If there's no one behind me, then I'm not leading. Okay? So the point behind prohistome is that I stand up for God's purposes, and because of my stand, other people recognize that I'm leading the charge, and I am involuntarily put in that place. I don't lead because I choose it. In fact, I have some really great quotes about this. That the person who, I wonder if I have it here. Okay. Yeah. So there's a great quote that goes something like this. The person who seeks power is the last person on earth that you want to have it. Okay. Because the point of prohistome, leadership, is that I'm pushed into that position, not that I choose it, right? And the best example is Moses. Moses was a superb general. He was a born leader, but he's also the one who didn't want the job, right? I mean, he argues with God, please don't give me this job. I'm not capable. I'm not worthy. I'm the wrong person. I'm the wrong era. I've forgotten my Egyptian, you know, all that. He's got every excuse in the book. Why? Because he recognizes that leadership comes with enormous responsibilities, including the responsibility of being in charge of everyone that you lead, right? Remember Moses' declaration in Deuteronomy? We're going to talk about this. I don't know why I don't have it in my notes, but it'll come up again, okay? In Deuteronomy, Moses says, the reason that I'm not allowed to go into the promised land, by the way, in Deuteronomy, he says, it's not because I struck the rock, right? He just ignores that. What he says is, the reason I'm not going into the promised land is because of your stubbornness. I was responsible for you, and I failed to get you in line with God's purposes, and God is punishing me by not allowing me to go into the land because of your stubbornness, right? In other words, Moses recognizes that as a leader, I'm responsible for the behavior of the people that I lead. Imagine that. Imagine if we had leaders today who actually were responsible for the behavior of the people that they're supposed to lead, right? Imagine that we had people in leadership who actually didn't want to be there, and they were pushed into it because They had a natural gift for directing people, and all the time that they're doing it, they don't want to, right? That's the kind of leadership that Paul's talking about. It's not leadership by vote, and it's not leadership by accumulation. It's leadership by forced divine design, right? Okay?
Skip. So the, Skip. Yes. Skip. I'm sorry. Can I interject something quickly?
Yeah, sure. Go, Larry.
Something, I want to know if you find this as surprising as I do, but Douglas MacArthur, the general, right, quotes this, a true leader has the confidence to stand alone, the courage to make tough decisions, the compassion to listen to the needs of others. He does not set out to be a leader, but becomes one by the equality of his actions and the integrity of his intent. I thought it was a great quote.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what Paul's talking about. Yeah. He doesn't choose to be a leader. He isn't vying for the position. He's pushed into it because of the qualities that he has, and people recognize that, and they desire to follow him. Okay? And you can think about that in terms of Yeshua, right? I mean, quite frankly, Yeshua doesn't recruit. Remember, the rich young ruler comes to him. You think, wow, this is the perfect guy. He can fund my ministry. He's got connections with the community. He's well known. What does Yeshua say? Basically turns them away, right? The Greeks come to him. What does he say to them? I don't have time for you. I mean, he's exactly the opposite of a person who's looking for power, okay? And yet, his stance is so attractive that people are drawn to him. And why does he say that, okay? Remember his verse, the statement. No man comes to the Son unless the Father draws him. So even when people come, he doesn't say it's because of me. It's because the Father brought them. Okay? Very different perspective. That's, I think, what Paul has in mind here. Okay? Let's see if we can do one more. So he says, who shows mercy with cheerfulness. Okay, so mercy is a really interesting word because in Greek, mercy is ilios, but in Hebrew, mercy is chesed, right? This is, how do we know that? Because in the Beatitudes, Yeshua quotes from Psalm 37:11 in the Beatitude that says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. But it doesn't say that at all. And so we know that Yeshua is using a Hebrew word that's been translated into Greek. And if we look at chesed, we discover that it most of the time is translated as mercy when we get into the Septuagint. Okay? So we know that the concept behind what Paul's got in mind here is chesed. So now that changes everything about what we mean when he says be merciful. What he's saying is a person who has this deep experience of relationship, connectivity, transitivity, and action, that kind of person, that chassid, that person is the one who demonstrates God's heartfelt benevolence and concern for others. That's mercy, okay? Mercy is not, oh my gosh, I just feel so sympathetic with you, and I'll do what I can for you. That's not mercy. Mercy is this deep sense of connectedness, this deep sense of responsibility, this deep sense of relationship, so much so that it propels me to act on behalf of you or the community, right? And you can look at all the stuff that I've written on chesed and all the discussions that we've had about that to see what Paul must have in mind, because he's using a Greek word that is a direct connection to the Septuagint translation of chesed. Okay? So, so we get to verse 9. Let's see if we can finish verse 9 and then we'll stop for today. So he says, now he's finished the gifts, right? So you've got a whole list of gifts and you can go through your collective understanding of what's happening in your community and ask, do we have people like this? Because the integrity of the whole community and the fulfillment of the community, the telos of the community, its completion, is to have all of those gifts show up in the same assembly, right? Somebody should be doing some of that, and maybe more than one person, to have the assembly be a full-fledged kingdom representative, okay? A representation. So let's look at 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cleave to what is good. So there's really a couple of important things going on here. Okay, the first is without hypocrisy, which Uriel translates as sincere. And that's about right. The word occurs in the Septuagint in wisdom literature, and it describes God's eschatological salvation. It denotes simplicity. It's the purity of the kingdom. Okay? So without, you know that the Greek word for hypocrite is a person who holds, it came from the theater. It's a person who holds a mask in front of their face to portray someone in the mask, but their real sense is behind them. Okay? So a hypocrite is one with a hidden agenda. And by the way, that will take us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, because the serpent, who is the craftiest of all creatures, knew how to hold up a mask. Okay? So what Paul's saying is don't be like that. Be like Genesis chapter 2, where you're transparent in your actions. Okay? So, and he says, without hypocrisy, right? So love, we got that one, right? And there's a whole bunch of stuff that we could talk about there. Without hypocrisy, abhor what is evil and cleave to what is good. Now, if I were thinking, where is Paul getting these ideas? I would immediately run back to Genesis 2:24, because the notion of hypocrisy comes from Genesis 3:1, and the notion of cleaving comes from Genesis 2:24. How do I know that? Because Genesis 2:24 is the paradigm case of what it means to cleave. When, you know the verse, right? And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. Okay? And the word there, in Greek, the word is, in Greek, the word is kolao, which means to join together. But it's connected directly to davak, which is this Hebrew idea. Okay? So now we're going to look at davak to see what does Paul mean when he says cleave to what is good. Okay? And I want to read you this little piece about davak, right? Davak also carries the sense of clinging to someone in affection and loyalty. It is communication. Devukut is a central theme of Jewish spirituality. Its foundation use comes from the Bible, where it describes the intended relationship between husband and wife, Genesis 2:24. This relationship serves as a model of the relationship between God and Israel from Deuteronomy 11:22. The cleaving of husband and wife together represents the ideal of what we may call pluralistic unification. Okay? Pluralistic unification, which animates both biblical and Jewish theology. Clearly, neither husband nor wife can become the other. But, just as clearly, neither humans nor God can become each other. Yes, in both cases, their unification is, at that level, is not possible, but pluralistic unification is, because pluralistic unification consists in an intimacy of service, bearing one another's burdens to the point of suppressing self-interest, but not to the point of self-erasure. Thus, we interpret the meaning as to cut out the Yitzhak Hara as completely as possible without denying the necessities that the Yitzhak Hara provides for the continuance of life. Okay? And that's from Misli Yisharim. So what is Devukut? What is Devak about? It's about the notion that I can't be who I am and who God intends me to be. I can't even be the full human that I want to be without a deep connection to other people, and particularly to some other one that I suppress my Yitzhak Hara needs for the benefit of the other. Right? I learn how to put my Yitzhak Hara in the service of the Yitzhak HaTov for the good of another. And the reason that I can do that is because bearing another's burden is the foundation for my ethical relationship to the world and to other people, and ultimately to God. Right? So, to love your neighbor as yourself means, first, to love the closest neighbor, which of course is the husband or the wife, in such a way that my Yitzhak Hara, which I need in order to survive, now serves the good of the other person. Okay? And when I understand that, then I understand what cleaving is. And I'm absolutely convinced that Paul has that in mind from the Genesis passages when he uses the words for cleave and when he uses the word that will remind us of hypocrisy, of the double agenda. Okay? He just draws this Gentile audience into the assembly and he says, you see, if we go all the way back to the beginning of the Torah, we're already talking about the same things. Okay? All right, we're going to stop here. It's quarter after the hour. I thought maybe we would get further, but there's a lot of stuff here. So anyone have comment that you want to share before we close?
Yes, Kip, a couple of things I have. Well, one is the word that came up here for me, which is for evil, is poneros in Greek.
It can there's more than one. Kakos is the usual one for evil. Poneros is also a word that's used for evil. Okay. The Hebrew is of course Ra, right? The Yitzhak HaRa. Okay.
Oh, it's Ra. Okay. I was wondering if it was
so
Ra or not.
Paul is thinking Ra, evil. And in Greek Greek is a definitive language, not a broad language, not a broad-based language. So one word in Hebrew can mean many different words in Greek. And the word that he's going to use later in the same chapter when he talks about evil toward no man is kakos, but here it might be poneros.
Right, okay, that's that. Another question is, it seems to me all this list he's giving us is just a model for us to live by. But throughout my church life, I've seen very little of this in people. My criticism is positive, it's not negative. One is, I don't think they understand all these terms. So there's a problem with the translation.
Yes.
And second is, they would give people duties in the church according to their status or their social status in the church.
Yes.
So I haven't seen this working out. Obviously, I have seen cases, isolated cases, but not as a body working in the church. Maybe that's the reason the church is so ill.
Yeah, it could be because I once was part of an effort to write a book about how this fits into the church. And one of the things that comes across right at the beginning is that the church does not follow Paul's example of how the model should work, because the church assigns people positions based on the church's needs, not on the person's gift. So you often have people who are doing things because of what the church decided they needed to have done, instead of people exercising their gift and finding divine flow through them, right? Which means that you hamper the entire assembly because people are not doing what they were gifted to do. Right? Why does that happen? Because in my view, the church is primarily about control. And it's very risky to say, well, we'll let God decide whose gift is going to be used in this environment, right? Because that puts it out of my control. So now I can't have a board meeting and decide who's going to run the administration, right? I have to have somebody come forward who says, well, God's gifted me with administration. And that person, in my mind, might be totally unqualified. So because the church is built on the hierarchical model that comes out of pagan religion following the Roman Empire, it can't function like this, right? The real question is, does the synagogue function like this? Because the synagogue is supposed to be the model of what Paul's talking about, right? So we need some input there to see if the synagogue functions the same way or if it's been influenced by the Western Hellenism as well. Okay. Somebody else?
Thank you.
No? Okay. So we'll stop for today and I'll see you tomorrow. We'll finish chapter 12, I'm pretty sure, by tomorrow.